usher in a new year seems to encourage reflection on the 12 months just passed. Today we offer the chance to remember Iowans who died in 2012. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Katherine Perkins, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. This hour, we'll look back on the lives of educators and media professionals, an Iowa legislator and an Iowa legend. Some were very public figures, others very private. We offer this remembrance of a few as tribute to all. That's coming up on Iowa Public Radio's River to River, just after this news. From Iowa Public Radio News, this is River to River. I'm Katherine Perkins, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. As we get ready to usher in a new year, we thought it would be appropriate today to look back at the lives of some of the Iowans who were lost in 2012. We offer this program as a tribute to all, whether notable to one or many, who died over the past year, beginning with two Iowa educators. Barbara Marie Mack was born on October 26, 1952, in Des Moines and grew up on the city's east side. She graduated from Iowa State University with a degree in journalism and forged a career as a crime and courts reporter for the Des Moines Register and Tribune Company. She helped found the Iowa Freedom of Information Council in 1975 before pursuing a law degree at Drake University. She then joined the Register and Tribune's legal team, rising to general counsel and overseeing the sale of the paper to Gannett in 1986. That's when she started a new career at ISU's Greenlee School of Journalism, where she would teach for 26 years. She served as assistant director of the journalism school, and we asked her director, friend, and colleague Michael Bougea, how he would describe Barbara Mack.
She's probably one of the most fascinating individuals you will ever meet. Witty, well-read, by turns compassionate and curmudgeon. Fascinating in what she could do and where she's been and how she loves students. Mostly that, how she loves students. Anyone who knows Barbara knows that she had a bite as well as love, but it was the kind of hard love that would set you straight, and it's something that I personally miss.
In what instances, can you recall an instance when that hard love, or I think you said the word curmudgeon, would come out? And
well, she was a stickler for the English language, and Lord knows we need that. There was a student once who... she told me played video games all day, and he was disappointed in his grades, and he went to Barbara and said, I really want to do better in your class. And she said, well, how do you spend most of your day? And he said, well, I play video games. And she said, well, have you thought about not going to college, dropping out of college, and getting a manual labor jobs, and then using the money you have to play video games all day? If that makes you happy, then you shouldn't be in college.
And she meant it seriously.
She did. I mean, and there's some logic to it. If that's what you really love, why go to college? Just get a job and earn money and play video games. The student, I think, was at first taken aback, but then I think he came to realize that she was just saying, set your priorities straight.
Right.
Make sure that your priorities align with your activities. And I think that was the moral of that lesson. We have all these goals and aspirations. And Barbara said, well, what are you doing to realize them? And that was a very good lesson for that student and at times for me.
I want to talk, have you mentioned Barbara Mack as a friend, but also as a colleague there at the Greenlee School of Journalism? What has been her impact in her longtime service there as a media law professor?
Well, we have many wonderful alumni at the Greenlee School, and Barbara Mack ranks, in my opinion, up there with Jack Shelley. And Jack Shelley was a teacher, he wasn't an alum, but icons like Jim Schwartz. Barbara was all of that and a beloved teacher to thousands and thousands of students. And I think those students really miss her, and I know that I miss her too, because she had a common sense logic that really set you straight. And I was just giving I was asked to speak at a retreat here today, this morning, and part of my presentation was make sure you have a good sounding board. And I realized that Barbara was my sounding board, and she was a sounding board for many more people besides me. And I think we all kind of miss that.
Mm-hmm. What about her made her such a great sounding board? What could you count on when you ran an idea past her?
She'd tell you the unvarnished truth. She'd tell you if you needed to straighten up and fly straight. She would tell you if, yes, you were right about that, but you could have presented it in this fashion.
You've told us a couple of anecdotes already, but I wonder if you had another favorite story about Barbara Mack to share.
The favorite story that I had concerned when I came to Iowa State University. I was a finalist in 2003, and it was a terrible blizzard at the time. And nonetheless, I got on a flight and managed to brave the weather and land in Des Moines. And there was Barbara waiting for me, and she said, "Oh, I'm glad you're here. Let's go see my horse, Mickey. I hear your nickname is Mickey. I have a horse named Mickey. Let's go see her." So off we went to the barn. And then she introduced me to this extraordinarily large white horse, stood at least 16, 17 hands high. And at that point, I really knew that I had to make a home out of Iowa State and that Barbara would become one of my best friends, if not my best friend, just because she had that way of taking you out of your box, kind of surprising you. And when she did, she looked inside you and she saw who you really were, and then she embraced that.
Mm. You're reminding me of a phrase, and I'm not going to get it right, but it goes something like this, that each of us are made up in small part of all the people we meet in our lives.
Oh, that's true. And I think what Barbara had that was a special quality was taking the best from people that she met and incorporating it into her conscience. She was a person of conscience as well as consciousness. She stood for justice, but she also stood for compassion. And I think beyond that, she gave you grace. When you felt you've done something wrong and you confided in her, she would say, "That's okay. I understand. I've been there before." That value of grace is so scarce in society. It acknowledges that we're only human. And Barbara had that singular capacity, not only to bring us out of the box of ourselves, but to reach in, touch us, and really make a connection on how we should perform and what our priorities ought to be.
To show that tough love, but at the same time, when needed, to be that forgiving soul.
Yeah, sometimes in the same sentence.
Now, you mentioned she was adored as a teacher by many generations of students. What was she like as a teacher in the classroom, as a mentor?
Well, you know, she would sit down often on the desk and just share her vast knowledge. Her knowledge of literature, her knowledge of journalism, her knowledge of law, her knowledge of ethics. She would tell anecdotes, things that had happened to her in her capacity as a litigator for the Des Moines Register, for instance. And she would also hold students to really high standards, standards of accuracy in news, fact, for instance, grammar, syntax, punctuation, spelling. And I tell you what, she believed in it so much that she tutored dozens and dozens of students every semester who couldn't pass our English proficiency test. She made sure she communicated to them the value of the English language and that it was key in the discipline that they chose. She did this and so much more.
And it's hard, based on that, it's hard to estimate how many lives she touched, how much of an impact she made on this world through all the people she taught. And
that was, and I'm only giving you half of her life. She had another life in Des Moines, a life of friends, a life of gourmet dinners, a life of entertainment and movie reviews and just a rich friendship with so many in Des Moines. So she had two lives, but in those two lives, academic and personal, she exhibited the same outstanding qualities of tough love, compassion, forgiveness, and grace.
Michael Bouget, you wrote a poem for Barbara Mack that you dedicated to her and read at her memorial. I wonder if we could end this conversation with your reading of your poem dedicated to her.
Thank you for allowing me to do that. It's been a catharsis for me to write this poem and even now to read it. The Wondrous Array for Barbara Mack, 1952-2012. We summon you today as anecdote, recalling how you confiscated phones when freshmen read their Facebook during class, or how you taught the narcoleptic tardy punctuality and punctuation. You laid down law in law, and still they came to love the level scales of justice as much as you, replacement mother, away from home and harvest. Far too soon, the drought-resistant corn has tasseled tidily in test plots like alumni bowing at commencement, row by row. You left us at your favored time of year, another term supposed to be your last. We plan to celebrate retirement with colleagues who assemble here instead and listen to the peals of campanile as you alight among us here and there, untouched but felt, unheard but understood, unseen and yet beheld in wondrous array.
Michael Bouget, chair of the Greenlee School of Journalism at Iowa State University, reading a poem written for Barbara Mack and read by Michael at her memorial. Barbara Mack died in August of 2012. Thank you for this celebration of her and this remembrance, Michael. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Barbara Mack died unexpectedly at her home on August 22nd. She was 59. Samuel L. Becker was Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Communication Studies at University of Iowa and served the UI in numerous capacities over his 43-year career. He also was very involved in the operation of WSIU Radio, serving as faculty advisor for the station and later on the advisory board as WSUI became a part of Iowa Public Radio. Our colleague Dennis Reese offered this remembrance.
Sam Becker may have been the most important figure in the history of the University of Iowa in the last half of the 20th century. You might ask, couldn't you find a UI president who was more important? Maybe, but Sam was Mr. University of Iowa for decades. Born in Quincy, Illinois, he started his studies as a freshman in Iowa City in 1940. As the unofficial archivist at IPR's Iowa City stations, I have found wonderful black and white photos of Sam taking part in live drama productions at WSUI, standing tall with a script in his hand and a sound effects man in the background, wearing a tweed suit at age 19 in one of the grand old studios in the now demolished 1939 radio addition to the engineering building. Sam was a devoted public radio listener and went on to be faculty advisor to WSUI in the 1950s. He finished all three degrees at the UI, a 1953 Ph.D. In 1977, I started as a graduate student in the UI's Department of Speech and Dramatic Art, now called Communication Studies, then located on the top floor of Jessup Hall. I didn't know Sam when I started my studies, but at that time, all new grad students were required to take a one-credit-hour class, I forget the title, but basically an indoctrination to grad studies. Some of it was just learning the MLA style book. But the highlight was a lecture from Professor Samuel L. Becker. On day one, Professor Bruce Gronbeck introduced Sam, and we waited a minute for the great man with a bow tie to enter the room. We sat spellbound. We knew we were in the presence of one of the top communications scholars of the century. But there was no pretension there. Sam had a sort of rustic look and a way of talking that was as straightforward and plain as an Iowa farmer. The takeaway for us new grad students? Do not forget to treasure our time with him, trying to figure out how he could be so insightful, such a prolific writer of the finest scholarly articles, all the while being down to earth and generous with his time and willing to drop what he was doing to spend whatever time you needed with him in case you were stuck on how to annotate your essay. After the semester finished, all of us would be invited to Sam's grand old Victorian house on Park Drive for a party where Sam showed off his library and the fruits of his hobby, winemaking. Funny thing about Sam, he always looked a lot younger than he was. When he retired at about 70 as chair of communication studies, the university just wouldn't let him fade away. They needed him, and he served in a number of critical positions, such as acting provost, well into his 70s. Can it really be that he was 89 when he died yesterday? He didn't seem that old. He just gave up driving a couple of months ago. He knew it was time, and he gave away his car to his grandson. Over the years, I never saw him at social events without his beloved wife, Ruth, at his side. She died a few years ago, and Sam spent his last years at Iowa City's Oak Knoll retirement residence. I think he liked it there. He stayed very active, writing and attending community events. I hope he was proud each time he drove by the Samuel L. Becker Communication Studies building. I told him recently that I had located a copy of a book of his, an early book, a manual, on the techniques of television production, copyright 1954. In his usual self-deprecating style, he said it wasn't that great of a book. But I know better. It was one of the earliest TV production books ever published, and I'm sure that people like Walter Cronkite must have read it. Sam, you will be missed. I'm just one of your thousands of former students who were influenced and changed by you. I can't even begin to imagine how many of your PhD students have gone on to be some of the world's leading teachers and scholars. I didn't become a scholar, just a public radio guy. But I'll never forget your 1977 lecture in Jessup Hall, room 402, telling us new grad students that it's really all about community and that whatever we learn should be shared. Get the footnotes right, but respect learning and strive to be a decent person. Sam, we love you. You're our professor for all time. I'm Dennis Reese.
Sam Becker died on November 8th. He was 89 years old. Pan Benicia, a bonobo at the Iowa Primate Learning Sanctuary, formerly known as the Great Ape Trust in Des Moines, died of complications from pneumonia, just shy of her 27th birthday. She was born at the Language Research Center at Georgia State University in 1985, but had been living with her bonobo family in Des Moines since 2005. Pan Benicia used a Lexigram keyboard to communicate with her caregivers and researchers, and was involved in numerous projects to study language acquisition, tool making, and creativity. Resident scientist at the Learning Sanctuary, Sue Savage Rumbaugh, says the bonobos and her human caregivers are feeling Pan Benicia's loss.
Well, Pan Benicia's absence has left a giant hole in the group, and we are all working to go forward. The thing we must avoid is all focusing on that hole. We have to all pull together and realize there is a future. I can tell you that Maisha, Pan Benicia's mother, as soon as I went in with her after Pan Benicia's death, grabbed me and hugged me and hugged me and hugged me and hugged me. She didn't let me go for maybe 20 or 30 minutes, and she put her head right on my breast, and then she wanted me to put my head on her breast and just held me, and you could see tears in her eyes, and you could also see tears in the eyes of Maisha, her son, who was, I guess, kind of Pan Benicia's favorite male at that point in time. And Pan Benicia sort of had the role of keeping young Maisha in line, because he tried to boss everybody around in the group, and Pan Benicia kind of kept him in line, and he loved Pan Benicia very much. And Inyota and Kanzi and Alikia were very depressed and sad and silent, as were many of the staff, and certainly my sister Liz and Liz's daughter Heather, who grew up with Pan Benicia. It was a tragic loss. Pan Benicia was in a way, everything. She was mother, sister, daughter. She was, of all the bonobos, she had crossed the line into humanness far more than any other. And although I didn't ever take her out into the human world, it certainly would have been possible for her to enter the human world without attacking people. She understood her role as a bonobo. She understood that she was different. Panmanisha often watched television shows about people contemplating their relationships to apes. She spent a lot of time studying what people thought about apes by watching it on television. And you could ask her deep questions about the topic. Saying such things goes far beyond the science that I've done to date. It is the kind of science I hope to be able to do in the future. But in my life, Panmanisha was a being of the first order. She was an inspiration to me. She was far more than what we would call a bonobo. She was a very, very special being on the planet. And I can only say that now I feel her around everywhere. Somehow she's here. She is everywhere.
Panmanisha died on November 6th. She was 26. State Senator Patricia Ward represented Clive, West Des Moines, and Windsor Heights in the Iowa legislature. She was first elected in 2004 and had planned to stand for election this year, serving as an assistant minority leader in the Senate Republican caucus. Governor Terry Branstad called Ward a champion for her district, who took the time to get to know the issues and worked in a bipartisan manner to enact meaningful legislation on behalf of her constituents. She always had a positive outlook on life, even in illness, and her smile would brighten each room she entered. Iowa Senate Majority Leader Michael Gronstahl, a Democrat, said, "Senator Pat Ward was a legislator who stood up for what she believed in and worked across party lines on behalf of her constituents. Pat will be missed." On October 15th of this year, Senator Ward lost a 3-year-long battle with breast cancer. She was 55.
Moon River, wider than a mile, I'm crossing you in style someday. Oh, dream maker, you heartbreaker, wherever you're.
We're looking back on some of the lives lost in 2012. Still to come, we listen to a conversation with one of Iowa's most famous natives, Andy Williams. That's as River to River continues on Iowa Public Radio.
We're after the same rainbows and waiting round the bend, my huckleberry friend, Moon River and me.
This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Katherine Perkins, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. We're looking back this hour on some of the Iowans whose lives were lost in 2012.
Iowa Public Television presents FAIR 2011. Here is your host, Mark Pearson.
Hello, I'm Mark Pearson at the fairgrounds again to bring you more of Iowa Public Television's 41st year of coverage and our final night of highlights from FAIR 2011.
Mark Robert Pearson was a longtime farm broadcaster in Iowa. Born in Lafayette, Indiana, Pearson came to Iowa to work in WHO Radio's farm department in 1980. After moving around for a few years, he returned to Iowa in 1991 to become host of Iowa Public Television's Market to Market program.
This is the Friday, May 25 edition of Market to Market, the weekly journal of rural America.
Hello, I'm Mark Pearson. Orders for big-ticket factory goods edged up.
He also returned to WHO Radio as host of The Big Show in 1993. And one of the events he is best known for covering was the annual Iowa State Fair, mostly the ag-related contests.
We're here at the first in 50 years weed identification contest at the Iowa State Fairgrounds, and we know it's the first time in 50 years that we've had a weed identification contest here at the fair, because the last winner of this event, we will be talking to a little bit later on, he's a man everyone knows and loves, Mr. Herb Plambeck. And the weed identification contest is underway. I may just take a crack at it, being an old farm guy and ag-type person, so let's have at it.
But he also found himself on the sillier side of the fair.
We are here on the concourse stage. We're getting ready for the Mr. Legs competition, and unfortunately, it'd be a conflict of interest for me to participate. Otherwise, I'd be the obvious winner.
Pearson didn't seem to take himself too seriously, and each year he signed off IPTV's fair coverage the same way.
Well, until next year, I hope you remember this fair is made for you and me, and from all of us at Iowa Public Television. I'm Mark Pearson. Thanks for watching, and I hope you had fun at the fair.
Mark Pearson died at his home in East Piru Farm on June 3rd. He was 54. Joan Bunke was the Des Moines Register's books and arts editor for 23 years, but her newspaper career spanned more than 40. According to a story in the Register, it was her practice to review every movie that played in Des Moines, believing that it gave readers a benchmark for their own tastes. Robert Fridley is the 95-year-old president of Fridley Theaters, which operate throughout Iowa and Nebraska. He knew Bunke through her reviews of the pictures that played on his screens.
Well, originally, when I bought the Varsity Theater in Des Moines in 54, she was an assistant to the reviewer. And then when the reviewer retired, as I recall, Joan Bunke took over and not only reviewed movies, but books as well. In fact, when I would visit Joan Bunke at her office at the Register and Tribune, her office just piled with books every place. When I read about her death in yesterday morning's paper, I was quite taken aback, almost shocked, because she always seemed pretty youthful, and although she said the story, rather, mentioned she was 78, she always appeared quite youthful, because I'd run into her in more recent years at, well, mainly at our theater in Pleasant Hill, because after she was reviewing, she still had a great interest in getting out and I imagine especially going to movies.
I would think so. So what do you think is her legacy or will be her legacy?
Well, I would guess she was probably a reviewer at the Register longer than any other movie reviewer and possibly book reviewer. I don't know about previous to 1929, which was the year my family moved to Des Moines, but anyway, too often critics seem to review movies for themselves. She was reviewing them for the public or for the audience that attends the movies.
What's the difference? What do you mean?
Well, often when I read a Roger Ebert review, and he's a good critic, but too often it is what appeals to him in the movie rather than the audience that is going to go to see it. Where Joan, I think, took the audience more into consideration in writing her reviews.
Is there a particular review or movie that she wrote about that you will remember?
Well, especially if she wrote a very good review of The Sound of Music. We had opened it on release back in 1965 at my Capri Theater, and course, the movie got off to a good start with her very fine review.
You also mentioned to me that she wrote a review of some old movies that you decided to play in some theaters.
Yeah, I took a lease for only 18 months on a theater called the Wakanda in the Wakanda Shopping Center. And a former employee of mine was operating the theater as a revival house, but it wasn't doing too well. And so I bought his equipment, got the rent reduced, and started showing old movies and also some art product. And one day Joan and I got to talking about a favorite comedy of mine. It was about 15 years old at the time. It's a British comedy called The Wrong Box. And she said if I would bring it back, she would review it as though it were a new movie, although it was about 15 years old at that time. And with her outstanding review, the picture started drawing in the crowds that played for 5 weeks, where before, the picture might last for 3 or 4 days at the fine arts. Then it happened again when we were visiting about a comedy that starred Peter Falk, where he plays a woman at times in the picture. It's about a heist of a jewelry store, and it was called Happy New Year. And again, it had a long run. I think Joan loved what she was doing, and it certainly showed in her work. She stands out so much more in my mind than any other critic we ever had in Des Moines.
That's Robert Fridley, president of Fridley Theaters, remembering Joan Bunke, longtime Des Moines Register books and arts editor. A friend and colleague, Daniel Finney, remembers Bunke as tough and smart. He writes on his blog, "You talked to Joan Bunke, and you knew that you were talking to someone who knew what the hell she was talking about. She had done the reading. She had reread it twice and was going to look it up one more time to be sure." Joan Bunke died December 24th. She was 78. Andy Williams was described by the New York Times as a crooner who defined both easy listening and wholesome easygoing charm for many American pop music fans in the 1960s. Born Howard Andrew Williams on December 3, 1927, in Wall Lake, Iowa, he began singing at an early age in the church choir his father directed. Iowa Public Radio's Rick Fredrickson sat down to talk with Williams at the Andy Williams Moon River Theater in Branson, Missouri, in 2010, and asked about the beginnings of his career.
We started on the radio when I was about 9 in Des Moines on WHO. We were on that station on the Iowa Barn Dance Frolic for about 6 years. And we did other shows, too, besides the barn dance. But that was the beginning of the Williams brothers' career. And then from there, we moved on to Chicago for a year. And then Afro came in and changed everything because, you know, everything then was live on these radio shows. And when Afro came in, which was the union, American Federation of Radio Artists, the scale that they made for everybody that was performing was so much more than anybody was getting that the radio stations all fired everybody and they started playing records. That's when the disc jockey started. Mm-hmm. So because of that, we moved to Cincinnati and did some more shows in Cincinnati for 2 years. Did show in the morning called It's Time to Shine by Griffin Shoe Polish. And it was a 15-minute show we did every day. We did 5 days a week, and then we went to school.
How would you describe your Iowa upbringing?
It was very hometown. You know, I was born in Wall Lake, Iowa, which is at that time 749 people. I think it's maybe 750 now, but it was, you know, everybody was very friendly. Everybody knew everybody in town. There was only a telephone line with an operator that shut down at 9 o'clock at night, and you couldn't call her unless it was a fire or, you know, a bad accident or something, you know, that required attention right then.
What about in the home, your father's influence over the Williams boys?
Well, my father wanted us to sing. He was an amateur musician. He played several instruments, but not professionally. He was a railway mail clerk. He worked on a train, sorted mail when the train was moving. But he started the Presbyterian Church in Wall Lake didn't have a choir because they didn't have that many people coming to church and the Presbyterian Church. So my father formed a choir of my mother and father and my two older brothers. And they became the choir, and they were singing the four-part. And my brother Dick and I started listening to all the rehearsing that they were doing and sang along with them. And then until we could, you know, sing four parts too. And then when my father knew that, then he thought that he had something that he could sell.
Maybe that's the 75-year milestone. Were you singing in church with your brothers then?
I was, yeah.
You mentioned a number of times in your book about your father's pushing and pushing and almost to the point that it made you feel like you weren't good enough. And that emerged throughout your memoirs. Did that hinder or really enforce you to success in your career?
Well, it was a two-edged sword because it got us all working, it got us all practicing, and it got us all rehearsing. Because he said to all of us one day that he said we had to work harder than other people because we weren't quite as good as the rest of them, which is a terrible thing for a father to say to his children, you know, in retrospect. But at the time, he thought that was a way of getting us to practice and to work harder. And that stuck with me, you know, a kid 7 years old, when my father said I wasn't quite as good as the others. I carried that all through my life, you know, that I wasn't quite as good. So I was always a little bit shy and a little bit insecure. Had very little self-confidence because I didn't think I was quite as good as everybody else. So I worked harder.
I take it you've overcome that.
I have, but it took a long time. Only recently, you know, in the last, say, 19 years since I've been here in Branson, have I got over the feeling that maybe I really do belong here. You know, maybe I am all right. I was very successful all through my career. Except the beginning. The beginning was very difficult. But when I finally got rolling on the Steve Allen Tonight Show in 1955, I believe, and then started recording and started getting some hit records and all that, then it made a lot of difference. But up until that time, when I started out singing alone, I was singing in dumb clubs. Nobody knew who I was, and nobody cared, and nobody listened, and nobody, you know. And I wanted to give up many times. And just toss it in, say, this, I can't do this. Nobody wants to hear me. But this thing about my father saying, you got to work harder because you're not quite as good as the rest of them, kept me working, kept me going. And if it hadn't been for his saying that, you know, I probably would have not gone on. On the other hand, the other side of the sword is that I carried that with me all through my life. And when I came to Branson and started a whole new thing here with my own theater and my own band and my own lights and my own thing, and you know, I then suddenly realized that what I was doing was pretty good. People loved it. And then I gained that confidence that I never really had up until that time.
Do you have a fondest memory of Iowa, whether it's Wall Lake or Des Moines?
Well, the Christmases were special. You know, everybody in town knew each other, and everybody was open their doors at Christmas time and practically strung lights from one house to another. That may be a slight exaggeration, but that does give you an idea of about how much of a town that was all together and all friends and family. And every door was open. You could go in and get an eggnog or a Coke or something or a cup of coffee in anybody's home. And that was particularly memorable to me that other places weren't like that. You know, you go to Des Moines, it's a bigger city. And people in your neighborhood you know a little bit, but you don't know everybody. You don't know. So that's different. That I remember very well in Wall Lake.
Bobby Kennedy, you were very close to his family. It ended up being one of the more tragic moments in your life. You were with him during the assassination. And he's buried in your necktie. How did that happen?
Well, that happened because after he was shot, John Glenn and I went to the hotel where he was staying, which is the Beverly Hills Hotel, to pick up another suit and a shirt because the others were all bloodstained, and bring him back so he could be buried in that suit or at least be taken back to New York. And so we had that, but we forgot to get him a dark tie, a black tie, to go with the suit. I had one on, so we used that. And that's the one I guess he was buried with, that same suit and tie, shirt and tie.
Your favorite song? What's your favorite song in your career?
I guess I'd have to say Moon River, because I can still sing it after all these years and not get sick of it. And I'm lucky I didn't record, you know, Itsy Bitsy Polka Dot Bikini, because I would hate having to do that all the time and have that my theme song. But Moon River is such a great song, and it has such a wonderful arrangement that Henry Mancini wrote for me. It isn't the same arrangement I have on the record that was so popular, but it's a beautiful arrangement, and I love doing it every night. So I have to say Moon River is my favorite one, because I can still do it and love it.
Well, in your book, you said you want to be remembered for your music.
Well, I would. I'd like to be remembered for my music. I'd like to be remembered for the television shows I did, for the records I made, and that I was a good guy. That's about all you can hope for.
Anything else you'd like to say to your fans in Iowa?
No, I just say hello to all my friends in Iowa, and I still have some. And I just loved living in Iowa, and I will always figure that Iowa is my home.
Wherever you're going, I'm going your way. To drifters off to see the world, there's such a lot of world to see.
Andy Williams died September 25th in Branson, Missouri, from complications of bladder cancer. He was 84.
Waiting round the bend, my huckleberry friend, Moon River, and me.
And finally, we remember Iowa's fallen soldiers killed in Afghanistan, including 40-year-old Master Sergeant Travis Riddick of Centerville and 23-year-old Sergeant William Stacy of Redding, Iowa, both in the United States Marine Corps, and 25-year-old Sergeant James Skalberg Jr. of Emerson, 23-year-old Sergeant Joseph Richardson of Algona, and 19-year-old Private First Class Brandon Buttry of Shenandoah, all in the United States Army. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden, with technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio are available from our website at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Katherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.